Senate Revenue Committee for the 2005 legislative session. We're going to spend the first 2 weeks here just orienting ourselves to Oregon's revenue structure. Not sure if this is my second session in revenue. I'm not sure if my colleagues, Senator George, you've been on revenue before. And Senator Brzezanski?
New and bold world for me.
Well, these next 2 weeks will be, they will just be unbelievably interesting and thought-provoking, and we've got coffee.
I'm sitting on the edge of my feet. And I may have to start drinking coffee even though I don't currently.
No, you don't drink coffee.
But I have my juice.
Juice. And Senator Starr?
Yes, I've served on revenue, and I've enjoyed that. And as you know, I've asked the president to put me on revenue instead of my son. So we'll see if that happens. And if it does, I'll rejoice. And I know my son will. He wanted very much to serve on revenue, but it just comes at a bad time in the schedule for him. And so we've asked for the change.
We are normally an afternoon committee, and so that probably is part of the difficulty. This is the first time in a while that we've actually taken up the morning slot due to scheduling. So in some ways that could have affected Senator Bruce Starr.
He could have. And the other issue there that I told the president that I was eager to serve and would enjoy four committees, and Bruce said just the opposite, that he three committees was enough for his schedule, and yet we got the reverse. I got three committee assignments, he got four.
He got four.
So it fits my schedule, and without disrupting anybody else on the schedule, and so hopefully it'll work out.
Hopefully it does. From what I understand, I think the switch is in progress. So welcome.
Thank you.
To the committee. We have in front of you, we have, and we can come back to this at the end of our time this morning, we have the rules, which I think, Paul, are pretty standard in terms of our committee rules.
Mr. Chair, they are standard. They're the model rules that have come to you. And just I'll just remind you of a couple of things. Remember that for the committee to have public hearing, you just need to have one member, so that's we don't need a quorum for that. There's an issue, the chair sets a time, and we know the place, but an issue between 8:30 and 9, so that was something we had discussed, and so we have it set in the calendar now for 8:30.
And I thought for the orientation, because this tends to be, we can usually get it done in an hour and a half, that we would start at 9 for at least these next 2 weeks while we oriented ourselves. Although if we run over today, we can certainly move it to 8:30, but that was my thought for the first 2 weeks of orientation as we mix in a few bills next week into our work.
Mr. Chair, is our designated time slot 8:30 to 10:30?
Correct.
Okay.
And we'll find, what I predict we'll find, the House certainly did, is that as we get busier in March, April, that'll be the difficulty with floor session, is we'll have to try to wrap up our work by floor. But I know the House Revenue Committee oftentimes found themselves having to be excused from floor as they just finished the work to get it to the House floor.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be our challenge. And we'll definitely, I think, be gone at 8:30 as soon as we get done with orientation.
So we'll start then at 9 tomorrow?
That's the plan.
Okay.
9 for the first 2 weeks.
A couple of other things to remind the members. There is some language on subcommittees to be appointed by the chair, but keep in mind that these rules apply to a formal subcommittee, and the chair, as he has in the past, may appoint work groups which are informal and are not subject to these guidelines. That those work groups can consist of members and non-members, and are not open to the not subject to the rules that are laid out for full subcommittee. Also, that votes require three members, not just the members present, so majority of the full committee. There is a new rule, at least we think it's a new rule, we haven't seen it, is number 7, which states that upon written request, the majority of the committee members, so 3 of you, can file a request with the committee chair and the secretary of the Senate to have a public hearing or work session on any particular bill that's in the possession of the committee. And I think that's a new rule.
It was on the House side. I know that it took a majority of the committee to have something scheduled if the chair was not willing to schedule it on their own. So
in writing, the right?
Side. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's also some language on number 11 and number 12 on minority reports. The timing of that is important because there's a 48-hour notice, and also there's the Legislative Council draft has to be produced within that time period. So that is something to keep in mind if that comes up. And finally, there is some flexibility on number 14 there. The correction of clerical errors on the amendments do not need to be approved by majority members. It can just be signed by the committee chair. So that's if there is a clerical or error in the draft itself. So those are the committee rules.
Questions? We'll return to those towards the end of the meeting, just in case folks have questions or comments or thoughts that they want to think about. Before you have our calendar, both the work plan that we have in place, and that is not including the bills that we'll be hearing. This is just what Paul, I, and then Senator Bruce Starr looked at in terms of a work plan of topic areas that we'd like to look at. Certainly, if there are any other areas that the members feel ought to come into that, please let me or Paul know, and we'll include that into the work plan. The first area is tax compliance and collections process. We've got a couple bills around this. We're going to look at what Governor Schwarzenegger is proposing in California in terms of compliance and collections and some of the governor's ideas that he's included in his budget in terms of tax compliance and collections. The next issue that we put down was local government fiscal issues, and this derives out of, and I think a work group might end up occurring on this issue, derives out of a meeting that Representative Butler and myself were at with the Association of Oregon Counties, really going through, and they'll meet with you probably, they're on your schedule this week, but the shared revenues that we have with counties and cities, which is obviously really important to them, but also the shared services that we have with the cities and counties, which is also critical to them. And the discussion was around, would it be feasible to allow the cities and counties, and this was more with the counties, more flexibility in terms of the services that they provide. Right now we provide a lot of statutory detail on what services, though not all the revenue that it takes to fund a county fair or the mental health system. And so that was a discussion. We'll see if it gets anywhere, but we certainly want to talk to the counties again about that issue, both the revenue part and the services that they're providing that they share with the state. But it'd be a big undertaking. Taxation of regulated utilities is the third item. We're waiting for. We had some hearings both last session, and then we had hearings in the interim around regulated utilities and the way the state taxes those regulated utilities. So we're waiting for a white paper that I believe is in draft form right now, and the final touches are being put on by the PUC Commission. I think we'll have Commissioner Beyer here within, I would say, the next 2 or 3 weeks to provide their thoughts and recommendations, if any, that they have for us in terms of how we work with our regulated utilities in Oregon. The fourth item is looking at federal tax policy changes. We'll have the whole Connect issue, which I believe the House is going to take up first. We'll probably get some bill. Is that right?
Right, Mr. Chair, that we do have a House bill that's connects to the federal changes that have been approved since the last session. The biggest one being the corporate income tax changes passed in November.
The federal level. And then I think it's important that we look at both the possibilities of tax reform at the national level, and we'll at least get some insight into what they're looking at, and then also just the issue of what was passed in the last 2 years since we've been here. A big item, obviously, is that Washington now is their sales tax is deductible, which is, I think, a pretty big change in the way that our neighbors to the north are able to deduct their taxes, and one of the strategic advantages that we've traditionally had, not having a sales tax. The next item is economic stimulus. We'll have a number of bills, as we always do, in terms of using the tax code to stimulate the economy, and this would be an area where we'll review what we did last session, whether it's the single sales factor or the R&D tax credit, and look at and hear bills that fall into that same category of stimulus. The next item, and these all could change, would be some sort of a reserve fund. I know that several bills have been filed in terms of reserve fund. The House certainly did a lot of hard work in the interim on the tax reform committee that we had. They did a great deal of work around a spending cap and a reserve fund, and so we have that on our agenda, and I think that will be could come up quicker than the sixth or seventh item. Next is school finance issues. The Oregon Business Council has proposed a whole raft of ideas around the school finance code. So again, this could be an item that gets bumped up, but there will be definitely changes and ideas both to the formula and how we distribute funds. And then the final item on that we've marked down is charges and fees as a revenue source. That's certainly been a greatly debated issue as we've talked about Oregon's tax structure and whether we're a high or low tax state, and are we a high or low fee and charge state. And so I think it's important that we definitely get to this, is to really look at the charges and fees that Oregon does impose, and take a look at what they're getting us and how they come about. Thoughts?
Mr. Chair, the only thing I didn't see covered in within the categories that we have was any review or consideration regarding tax expenditures. And I know that our caucus has made some desire to at least have that on the table for the future. So I request that we see if we can't have that at least as a possible topic in one of the categories where it would be appropriate.
Good thought. We'll include a review. We'll get a little bit of a review here in the next 2 weeks, but maybe start looking at, we'll definitely get some bills around tax expenditures and at least take a look at what we've done and what we have on the books. And I think everyone has, we certainly have them in LRO, the expenditure report, the big book that details Oregon's expenditures and what we provide out through our tax code in terms of expenditures and credits.
Mr. Chair, we'll make sure everybody gets a copy of that. I think you've all gotten copies sent to you, but we'll go through that and review it and ask the department to kind of review the assumptions they've made and how they arrived at their estimates.
Mm-hmm. And if there are particular expenditures that you feel we ought to look at in particular, mm-hmm. those, it's a big book, and we can kind of go over the whole income and property tax side, but it's usually useful to hone in on one or two or three or a group of them and really look at those and see if they're providing the stimulus that we had hoped for when we enacted them. And one thing I know at least some of the folks that are bringing new bills around credits are doing, I know the affordable housing people are, and some of the energy assistance is looking at past ones they've received in the past and saying we'd like these and we think these are more valuable than some of the past ones that we have on the books. To make it more revenue neutral, we'd like to lose a couple of the ones that we've had and gain this new, because the market's changing, at least in affordable housing. Okay. Senator Stone. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions on tax compliance and collection process. We were contacted by a constituent who works in collection and told a story about asking for some support, and they believe that if they could in fact accomplish a couple additional auditors in some areas, they could achieve some substantial additional returns into the state. What happened was something completely different from that, and actually some additional managers were brought in and actually split their team. Is it appropriate for this committee to look at those kind of issues? In other words, it is a management decision, but at the same time, I think it is affecting revenue collection. At least this person believes that's the case.
Yes, Senator George, I would like to actually look at we need to do it every few years, and just in meeting with Representative Butler, I think he was also interested. I'd like to look at the whole collections process, and that issue I think is very germane, just in terms of staffing, the way that we utilize the staff that we have. I think it's just it is time that we look at the whole system as a whole, rather than we're going to have a few bills that are already in the hopper around this. Governor Schwarzenegger just came out with a series of bills that I think are worth examining around the collections process down in California. And so my intent for that would be to be broad, at least at the beginning, with using maybe a bill as a placeholder, but then allowing the committee to just see what is there. I think the governor has $22 million in his budget for just this item, increased collections.
Good. Can I have a follow-up question?
Please.
School financing. Just recently, we traveled down to Linn County and met with a large number of people from county commissioners, the school board members, and superintendents. One of the things that they did is they provided a list of things that they believe we could do that would save them tremendous amounts of money. And I agreed looking at the list. It's some ideas we've looked at over the years. I understand now the School Boards Association and others are coming forward. Are we going to look at those kind of savings, viewing that as, the, you know, if you don't spend it, it's the same as revenue? Or is that going to be headed to education?
That's a good question. I know there are, with OSBA and I think the Oregon Business Council also has ideas, just within the system as a whole. And a lot of them, well, they would fall in our lap because anything that's formula or that special ed, just the regular school finance formula, is going to fall into LRO. And so I do think we'll see, we always do, a number of bills. But if it has any relationship to the school funding formula or special ed or transportation, then ultimately we're going to need to look at it and use it as savings and changes that may be made.
I'll bring that to our committee assistant then and allow them to duplicate what was presented to us, because I found it very encouraging that they were out there aggressively looking for ways that things we could do that would help to reduce their costs and provide, you know, that's dollars that will get in the classroom if we don't spend them for bureaucracy. And I think some of the suggestions were so valuable, and the insight that they had, and for example, some of the duplication that occurs within Oregon Department of Education that needs to be eliminated. They were indicating to us that base data was available on the web, and it was taking them tremendous staff time to duplicate things that were available to our people in the Department of Education here in the state. So that's the savings to the district. The savings to the district is the money to the classroom.
Although on that one, and we have the Vice Chair of Education here, I think that would fall into the Education Committee because it's structural in terms of the Department of Education.
Okay.
Senator Starr, Chair of Education.
Yes, I believe that we will definitely be taking that up, and some of the education lobbyists scheduled to meet with me this morning and to talk about just general issues affecting education. So, yeah, we'll be on that, because it is obvious that we don't have as much money as we'd like to have for education. So we're going to have to look at other ways we deliver services.
One of the benefits we do have is that I think two or three of our members both serve. There's an effort being made to try to get those who are on relevant policy and the Revenue Committee and the Fiscal Committee to try to get some level of interaction. And so Senator Starr will be a good source of that, and I serve on education also. But you're right, the issues are all interrelated. And I do think there's going to be a big effort to look at the whole K-20 system and how do you squeeze efficiencies out of it. And I know the OBC, the Oregon Business Council, has done actually a great deal of work, and at first glance looks like really good work in terms of how do you find efficiencies within just IT delivery and other areas. Other thoughts on the committee work plan before we just jump right into Dr. Warner. Paul?
Mr. Chair and committee, there's we always call it our bestseller. It's our public finance basic facts, and we've just updated that for you, the 2005 version. And we'll be following and talking about some of this material, but not exactly in the order. This is really to be a reference guide for you throughout the session, and hopefully it will serve you well. It has a lot of history in it, a lot of data, and I think it does address a lot of questions. One thing I will refer you to is the second page is a list of your staff for the from, let's say, Revenue Office, and we are organized by areas of specialty. Most of the staff I think you've worked with in the past. Our new economist, Mary Ayala, will be doing property tax and timber tax and some local government issues. She comes to us over the interim from the Florida Department of Revenue. So she'll be working with us this session. The rest of the staff I think you're pretty familiar with. Kim James is our office manager, and she's a good source for scheduling issues or whatever kinds of issues that come up that you need assistance on. Barbara Gardino is our committee assistant, but you can see that James doesn't look like Barbara, and he's Barbara unfortunately had the flu over the weekend, so James has stepped in to help us through the first couple of days. So, but Barbara should be back with us shortly. The next thing I have is an overview of the revenue system. And I will retire to the seat below here and walk through that with you.
And we will see all the economists who Paul mentioned. We'll see in the next few days Steve Meyer and Mazin and Lizbeth and Dr. Ayala. So we'll get a chance to work with the economists. Paul, one thing that you said the other day that I think is important, though, is that sometimes we don't utilize our economists as much as perhaps we could in other committees on commerce, on education, in terms of stimulus effect. So I've started to, but I encourage folks to really utilize the economists we have in LRO as much as we possibly can. They are a great source of information.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I apologize, but I need to step out for a few minutes to talk to my staff about my morning schedule, and I'll be right back.
Great, thank you.
What I prepared for you this morning is there's a copy of the overheads called Overview of Oregon's Revenue System. I do think that as the session progresses, and of course you've all been through this, that so much of your time is focused on individual issues and looking at the detail, making detailed decisions. This is one of the few times where I think we can kind of stand back and take a look at the overall system and think in terms of some context, and hopefully this will help you when you have to make those decisions in the future, to get a sense about the system and how it works and what its components are. I really want to try to address several questions. One is this macro view of the system, and it's really, there is no ideal revenue system. We can talk a little bit about the consequences of some of the decisions, but I think that, I'm trying to get back. The best way to look at our system in terms of those implications is to look at it in a comparative sense. How do we compare with other states? How is our system different? And I think you know that our system is quite unique, and we'll go through some of those factors, talk about how it's changed, certainly how it responded to the boom in the 90s and how it's responded to the recession and its aftermath. And we do think we're into a slow growth period now. And then finally, to wrap things up, a little discussion of strengths and weaknesses of the system. And I think you'll find that in revenue policy, you know, anything you do that corrects something, corrects a weakness, for example, or alleviates that weakness, you tend to have trade-offs. You tend to create some problems in other areas. So there's never a clear black and white answer. It's always weighing the costs and benefits of that decision and making the decision that, well, the benefits of this policy choice exceed the costs. And looking at those trade-offs. And what we try to do is the best we can to inform you what we think those trade-offs are and then put you in the best position to make those decisions. First of all, we have had a lot of questions over the years and continue to about Oregon's ranking. We do have 2001-2002 Census of Governments, which is every 5 years, was released in August of 2004. So we have a lot of detail that's fairly recent. Keep in mind this 01-02 year is right at the bottom of the recession. I mean, it is the trough. So that data is influenced by that. If you look at our comparative numbers, we've had a lot of confusion about, Oregon is a high-spending state. Well, in terms of per capita spending in 01-02 and in terms of per capita total revenue, we rank 11th. And, of course, in personal income taxes, we are high, ranking 6th. And in many years, we've been actually higher than that, or actually at a lower ranking near the very top in terms of income tax burden. We do tend to be in the middle in what we call own source revenue, and I'll define that for you in a minute. It excludes federal revenue, so it's really the revenue that's drawn from our own economic system. And, of course, in property taxes, we are right in the middle, and that's the big change over the last 15 years. It used to be a very high property tax state, and I'll show you those numbers. In terms of taxes, we are quite low, ranking 41st, meaning 9 other states have a lower per capita tax burden, and only 4 other states have a lower tax burden as a percent of income. Now, there's a couple of things about this 01-02 data that does, I think, artificially lower our ranking. One is we sent out a kicker check that year. So that was the last kicker that went out. It was $253 million. Of course, that's being contested now in the Bobo case, where we may end up with another $113 on that. But the other thing that influences data is the last payment on the federal pension case. Another $111 million was sent out in a refund to the federal retirees. So both those things lower us. What we tend to see, and in your public finance book, we have our ranking for every year back to the 80s. So you can see where we rank over the years. And we tend to rank in the high 30s now on a per capita basis.
So, Paul, when will we know our updated ranking? That's always a big issue, is where we rank within the 50 states in terms of tax burden.
Well, unfortunately, Mr. Chair, the census has not been a high priority in the federal budget in recent years, and they have actually dropped their annual reports and have gone to a biennial report where they every other year. This just came out in August of 04, and we probably won't see the 03-04 numbers until, I would guess, probably in a couple of years.
Okay.
So that whole reporting schedule has really slowed down, and that's unfortunate because we do get that question an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
These are the census categories, and you can see where we rank. And, of course, what this does is explain that issue what intuitively seems contradictory, that how can you be relatively high on revenue, ranked 11th here, and low on taxes, ranked 41st? Well, the answer to that is we rank relatively high in these other categories. Federal government, we rank 4th on a per capita basis. So our federal dependency is very high. Now, this is transfers to state and local governments. It's not transfers to individuals like Social Security or defense contractors. So this is to state and local governments. So, and this number is a huge number nationally. This last fiscal year is about $400 billion federal government sent out to state and local governments. And about 45% of that is held primarily Medicaid. So that category is growing rapidly.
What are the other big categories? Medicaid?
Medicaid is the biggest. The other category, transportation, is a big category. Natural resources is a big category. Education is growing, of course. We've seen with the No Child Left Behind program, it's it's gone up from about 6% to about 8% of school revenue. So those are the big categories in dollars. But the health is the one that's grown so rapidly because of the rising costs. Charges for service. The chair mentioned this is one of the components of your work plan. And one of the areas where we have seen increases in Oregon's relative ranking since the passage of Measure 5. So $1,106 per person, we rank seventh. So only six states have higher charges per person. The biggest dollar charge in the system is higher ed. That's tuition, but also if you have one of your children in one of the universities, you'll see you get a great big bill for charges for services that's in addition to your tuition. So higher ed is the biggest component here, really for all the states, but it's also in Oregon. It's grown rapidly. Miscellaneous revenue is predominantly interest earnings, and this number's dropped because interest rates have been low, but it also includes lottery. And that's, of course, what boosts our number relative to other states. This government enterprises and insurance trusts, I've combined these two categories. Government enterprises are OLCC, for example, which is a state-run monopoly. Public utilities that are owned, municipal public utilities. And the insurance trust funds are public employee retirement system, workers' compensation. So those all fit into that category. And these are current revenues. This is not any kind of projected liability or anything like that. These are just current revenues flowing in. Own source revenue is taxes plus charges plus miscellaneous. And you can see we rank about in the middle in that category. Now, in terms of our tax system, you can see the unique characteristics of this by the different components, of course, in taxes. And if you adjust for the kicker and the federal retirement case, this number tends to be ranked around second or third over the long term. So personal income tax burden quite high in the state. Corporate bounces around a lot because our corporate taxes, and we'll see Elizabeth will walk through our corporate taxes with you, is a relatively small number of corporations pay the bulk of the corporate income tax. So if they have a down year, then of course our ranking tends to drop. So we really saw this in the recession. Our corporate income tax collections in 2001-03 dropped by nearly 50%. Property taxes, we rank right smack in the middle at 27, almost identical in terms of our property tax burden to Washington. So that's, again, a change from the initiative. Sales taxes, there are four other states that don't have a general retail sales tax. Alaska has some gross receipt revenue, so they actually rank 46th, even though they don't have a general retail sales tax. But the other states here, Montana, Delaware, and New Hampshire, the other states that we rank with a zero per capita burden. We also rank relatively low on selective sales taxes, which are gasoline, cigarettes, beer and wine. A lot of states have a liquor excise tax. Of course, we have a monopoly. And other taxes here, weight mile tax, for example, would be in this category. Severance taxes, timber taxes. Yeah. So, of course, the feature that really stands out for us is this big red bar, the 70% of our, this is now back to state taxes, not state and local. 70% of those state taxes comes from the personal income tax. This is the highest percentage, not only of personal income tax, but of any tax. So we have the least diversified system from that perspective. Notice that here, on the U.S. average, general sales taxes in 2003 fiscal year, slightly higher than personal income taxes. Historically, that's been the case, but in the late 90s, with the stock market boom, personal income taxes actually exceeded sales taxes on a national basis because the income tax was growing so fast.
So are we still, you know, I've heard it spoken that we're more dependent on one form of tax than any state in the nation, and you always hear it having surpassed Tennessee. Is that accurate? Or,
Mr. Chair, that's accurate. If we look at these components right here, and this is the highest percentage of any of the 50 states for any one of those components. And this shows you some, this is kind of a comparative rankings, a group of states that we tend to look at, California, Washington, Idaho, Utah, Arizona, Nevada. And you do see quite a diverse type of revenue systems in the West. Certainly when you look at taxes, we'll look at that in a minute. But a couple of things. Oregon, when this is revenue now, so then this is state and it's revenue. Notice that Oregon has a relatively centralized system. 73% of revenue collected at the state level, and only Idaho of our comparative group would have an equal system. Our per capita rank in revenue is 17th, and was 11th for state and local. But I think one of the things that's surprising, at least to me when I first sorted this out in this way, is that we actually receive at the state level more in federal revenue than we do in taxes. So we are indeed that the dependence on the federal revenue for our budget really stands out here. And notice that we're higher than any of these other western states. And notice also that these western states have a higher dependence on taxes, about half their revenue. We're about a third. And then you can see some of these other categories, charges again, except for Utah, we rank higher than any of the western states. And on miscellaneous revenue, where a lottery comes in, we rank higher than any of the western states. In terms of taxes, see, we get a little different story on centralization because we don't have all that federal revenue showing up. We're about equal to most of the western states on percent from the state. Percent of income, our tax burden is low compared to the western states. Overall, we rank 37th. And here's our 70.6%. That was that big red bar. That is the highest in the country. The second highest of any of these categories is Washington's 62%. But the way census categorizes data, they include the B&O tax in there as a part of the sales tax. So this is an occupation tax for Washington is rolled into that 62%. So you can see some of these systems that are more balanced, such as Idaho and Utah, are just about equal in terms of personal income taxes and sales. California, a little heavily tilted toward personal income tax. And, of course, they were hit even harder than we were by the recession. Even though they have a lower percentage reliance on the income tax, a very high reliance on capital gains. And that was what they had, their capital gains revenue from the income tax exploded. They have even higher rate on capital gains than we do, a higher top rate. And, you know, that just plummeted and was one of the key factors in causing their fiscal problems and the deficits they've had to deal with. A couple of other things to note here. Of course, Washington, no income tax, but neither does Nevada. So you've got two states that border on Oregon that have no income tax. So that, you know, the competitive issues there are pretty significant. And, of course, not only no personal, but no corporate income tax as well. Nevada receives a lot of the revenue from sales taxes. They have a 6% gross receipts, gross gaming receipts. So that's a big chunk of that, which is actually, in effect, exported to their tourists who play the games there. So how has the system changed? From 89-90, I picked that year because that's the year prior to Measure 5. Measure 5, of course, approved in November of 1990. Measures 5 and 50 did a number of things. One is it certainly centralized the school finance system, and you've been, of course, dealing with the consequences of that in terms of your budget decisions. Lower property taxes, significantly reduced property taxes, lower overall taxes. And where we saw the growth was in federal revenue, and I would argue that a good part of that was a conscious policy, budget policy here in the legislature to use those federal dollars to maximize that leverage. And then, of course, the use of charges has increased both at the state and the local level.
So, Paul, that's going to be a big issue, though, because what I read is that the federal government is, on healthcare especially, going to clamp down heavily on a lot of the techniques that states like Oregon have used to help balance their budget and at least half the deficit at the federal level.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's a real risk. I mean, we've seen these kind of cycles at the federal level. when they have deficits of $400 to $500 billion, and we know that the administration is putting in place plans to cut that deficit in half, we're going to see some real a much tighter policy toward discretionary spending, and probably toward some of these other components too that have grown so rapidly. So yes, I think it is a significant risk for our budget environment, and we need to make the assumption that at least that rate of growth we've seen in federal revenue in the past is going to slow down.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul, the Muppel dollar is President Bush, when he was governor, did not ever do that. He didn't utilize that opportunity. And we saw as soon as he came into office him starting to turn that spigot off. Where are we in that relationship? My understanding is we're getting close to the end of the period that they're actually going to allow that to happen.
Yes, Senator, that's basically being phased out now. We don't have any Muppel revenue in the 03 and the 05, 07 budget projection.
So we are to the end of that?
We are to the end of that.
Okay.
This is a look at Measure 5 and its impact on property values and property tax levies. Well, one of the things that's kind of interesting to look at in your public finance tax near the back of the book here is a chart showing votes on revenue issues. And it goes, I think the first one we have on there is the McCall plan in 73. And then we just kind of update that each year, and it shows what the important ones were. One of the things that I think sometimes people forget is we had three Measure 5-like initiatives between the late 70s and 1990. So, and each one got closer to being approved. And you can see some of the pattern here. You know, from the 70s, this was the time when Governor McCall said to visit and don't stay. We had a strong population growth, strong real estate gains. Here's the market value of property growing over 25% in 1 year. Of course, highly inflationary period, too. And you can see property tax levies growing rapidly, too. But look what happened in the 80s when the real estate boom ended. We had very little value growth here, but yet property taxes continue to grow in the 5 to 7% range. The other thing that was going on in that period was that the legislature, in 1979 in particular, had passed a very large program, the Property Tax Relief Program, PTR program, that basically sent people a check to offset some of the costs of their property taxes. Well, that program was phased out with the budget problems in the early 80s, and so the real property tax burden was significant in here, and of course that was a lot of the driving force behind Measure 5 in 1990. Notice the effect of Measure 5 and its timing. It just happened to occur at a time when our real estate values were out of line with the rest of the West Coast, and we began a period of catch-up. And these are total values. Residential property was growing even faster in this time. So here's the tax collections dropping. The rate was phased down finally to $15 per thousand or $5 per thousand for schools. And here's the value growth during this period. Remember that Measure 5 was only a rate limit, nothing to do with value. It was a rate based on market value. So once you hit this rate cap here, this $15 per thousand in 95-96, the property taxes were driven by value growth. And here's the only year which we operated under Measure 5 without Measure 50. This is in the 96-97 year. And notice that our property tax levies grew about 12%, about the same as assessed value did that year, or as market value. So Measure 50 gets approved right after these bills get in the mail. People received these in October of 96 and voted on Measure 47 and became Measure 50. And notice the effect of Measure 50. Here's the cut portion of the cut and cap measure. And then you can see that property values and property tax levies have grown right about the 5% range since that time. And we think over the long term that's probably about where they'll stay. Also notice that pretty stable revenue growth here. And of course that's from a budgeting standpoint.
that's the strength, one of the strengths of the property tax is its stability. And Measure 50 was really added to that stability. And of course, the result of Measure 5 and then of 50 is to just take this local, state, and local share of school finance and just flip-flop them. So we're now at 70% of operating costs from the school. And of course, we'll walk through with you all the school finance, the formula issues that the chair talked about, and go through those, some of the changes that you made in the last session. We have sunsets on some of those things, and we'll walk through those. This is the major revenue sources and how they've performed over about the last 10 years. And notice the growth here in personal income taxes. These are annual data for all the states. This is personal income tax on a national level. And notice the growth here over 10%. And, of course, this is in a pretty low inflation environment. So very strong growth for personal income tax. Look at the sales tax performance, though. Right around 5%. And here's the effect of the recession. This is the drop of over 10% when the capital gains bottom fell out. But notice what happened to sales taxes here. About even, about flat. We didn't have a negative year on sales taxes. And but notice what's happening here. Here comes personal income tax coming back in 03-04. And sales tax is coming back, but not as much. They're back about this 5% level. So you do see more stability in the sales tax over time. You don't see this rapid growth that you see in the income tax during those good years. And you don't see as rapid a drop. What's even more volatile, of course, is the corporate income tax, which is a much smaller piece of this revenue pie for all the states, not only Oregon. But look at the drop here. As profits dropped way off. And what happens, of course, with the corporate income tax, you have major companies that have lots of employees and lots of operations. They won't pay any corporate income taxes because it's based on net income. And when you have a recession, they don't have any net income. They have losses. We always keep track, and I've actually got Washington data back into the 60s on a biennial basis, and their biennial dates and everything are the same as ours. So it's kind of interesting to watch their general fund. They do get some property tax in their general fund. We, in effect, count that property tax when we do our school funding formula, but they formally receive the property tax dollars in their general funds, about 12% or so of their general fund. But you can see how much stronger we were in the late 90s in terms of our revenue growth of 20%. And this is not adjusted for kickers or anything. This is just actual dollars coming in. And then notice that Washington, weaker growth in here, and then about flat, so they had a lot of fiscal problems too, but not anything near what we did. And of course, we also borrowed $450 million. And this number would have been about a minus 13%. Oh, and here they have, this is their latest, this is their November projections and our December projections.
Paul, do you recall the number that's forecasted for the corporate kicker?
Mr. Chair, the current projection for the December forecast is $43 million. Looking at that census data, I've only got one small change here. I don't have the insurance or the government enterprises. I'm looking at what's called general revenue because that's the data I have. But look at how different we are in 89-90 compared to those other numbers we looked at. Taxes, instead of 41st, were 19th. So our tax burden has dropped significantly. Charges, instead of being 7th, were 23rd. Federal government, instead of being 4th, were 9th. So you can see where that reliance has grown here. Miscellaneous, we've stayed about the same, gained a little bit. Own source revenue, we dropped from 18th to 28th. And general revenue, we've stayed about the same. We're 11th versus 12th. So it's kind of interesting. You see the shifts here, moving here, here, and here, growth in these components, and a sharp drop here in relative ranking on tax burden. So we're more dependent on these categories. On taxes, the big change is property taxes. We were 7th in 89-90, and now we're 27th. So in the sense that property tax initiatives, if the goal was to reduce the property tax burden, which I think that's what a lot of people were voting for, it worked. In the sense that the property tax burden has dropped about the middle. So now if you look at our system compared to 89-90, our taxes have dropped sharply as our revenue source from 54% to 42%. And so we're less dependent on that tax dollar. Here's where the growth has come federal from 20 to 30%. Again, so referring back to the chair's point earlier, you know, this is can be seen as a risk that we look ahead, as given the federal government's fiscal position. And charges have been the other area, 13 to 18%. Miscellaneous has dropped, but it's dropped for all the states and actually dropped less for us because of law. Okay. Now, our House members thought that my little picture here was referring to lottery, but it's supposed to just be dollars and cents coming in.
This the yellow is 25, the blue is 50.
This takes a look at the governor's budget and the revenue assumptions that are built into that budget. Your 0305 ending balance is about $91 million for the general fund. The old 507 projected resources, these are general fund resources, not including lottery here, about $11.2 billion, or 8.2% above the 0305 number. But if you look at that and compare it with 9901, it's about 6.7% higher. So actually, if you do the arithmetic there, the 0305 general fund resources are actually lower than 9901. So they've actually gone down in dollar terms. And the 6.7% higher than 6 years ago gives you about 1% annual growth. So you can see why you've had been confronted with a lot of difficult budgetary decisions in the last couple of years. Of course, the general fund, when we talk general fund, this number is actually growing. This big blue piece of the pie is up over and up to 90%. For 0305, almost 90%, even higher for 0507 projections. This other revenue piece in 0305 includes some one-time sources that we've talked about, such as the other fund balances that were shifted into the general fund. We do look at the 0103, we do look at the all funds revenue. The 0103 is actuals. I don't have a lot of faith in the 0305 estimates that are in the governor's budget. They're not audited, and so the numbers bounce around a lot. And so the 0103, these are actuals, and these numbers are all in the governor's budget, and they do show a couple of things the census data shows. One is that taxes are just a piece of that pie, actually a minority piece of it. Federal funds are a big chunk of the state budget. The thing that's really bounced around, and I do, by the way, in your public finance packet have the state budgets, both in terms of expenditures and revenues, going back to 89-91 each year. So if you ever need any numbers on that, you can look at it. And then I've got it. I have personal income, inflation, and population. So if you want to do some comparisons there or anything you want us to do on that, we can do real quick. The sliver that's been the most interesting here, if you look on that table, is this red one, which is interest. That's the way it's titled in the budget, but it's really investment earnings, and it's 90% PERS. So, for example, in 99-01, that number was about $4 billion. In 01-03, it's about $800 million. So you can see really the volatility of that. Of course, these are not dollars used for general purposes, but they can indirectly affect general purposes by increasing assessments when the earnings are down and the system becomes needs additional revenue in order to fund it. Another component that's really grown that doesn't really show up in the census data is the donations, and that's for higher ed has been a major category. Huh. This yellow piece here.
So those are private donations to higher education mainly?
Yes, correct.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, you remember the grief that you guys gave me over me, the tax me more fund? You remember that they actually set up a category to receive those, and it's kind of an amazing number how many people have made voluntary contributions and been able to direct it to the places that they wanted it to go to, and I think it's a great idea, Cecil. It was a good idea, Gary. The name was wrong.
That would show up in the
ghost of Senator Corcoran is with us here.
Discretionary revenue sources, here I refer to this 90% personal income is actually higher now, so we don't have some of these other categories. And the projections for 05, 07 corporate income tax are pretty flat. You've got the kicker that the chair mentioned, but you also have the assumption that we've seen a bounce back on corporate profits and they're going to start to, earnings are going to start to drop off, and the 05, 07 projections are actually lower than this current biennium. Lottery, of course, the important thing to keep in mind here is that this discretionary piece of the pie keeps dropping. So now you're well below half at 44%. Debt service, we're still paying mostly, it's on the school lottery bonds that were issued in 97 and 99. The Education Stability Fund is now at 18%. And the Parks and Natural Resources Fund stays at 15. Keep in mind that the governor's proposal, well, I guess it's one after this, that the governor's proposal to go to line games to expand total lottery revenue doesn't change those dedicated proportions. So he's got a $120 million assumption in there. 18% of that would go to the stability fund. And so now the projections in the governor's budget for the ending balance of the stability fund at the end of 05-07 biennium would be about $200 million.
So it's sitting there in the stability fund.
That would be at the end of the on June 30th, 07. So the revenue's flowing in, and with that 18% of a higher base, it's going to be flowing in even faster.
Well, I know we're going to get in this with Mr. Penn, I think next week, but it seems to me that $120 million is going to be a very aggressive number given the stability fund and the other allocations. It just seems that's going to be a tough target to hit with lottery growth. Senator George.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The major $66, Paul, those will rise dramatically too. Is there any movement in the governor's office to maybe think about, since we're having such a significant recovery in salmon, to backing some of those dollars out of there? Have you heard anything along that line?
I haven't heard anything, Senator. Of course, the percentage itself is set in the Constitution, so that's not going to change. But there is some flexibility with other parts of the budget. Now, I don't know the details.
Okay.
So this is my favorite graph. I'm a bit of a history buff, and so what I do is keep track of general fund revenue back to 1929. And you can see... I think this graph shows that, you know, as the policymakers, the legislature, and state policymakers have been used to revenue growth. I mean, that's historically been the pattern. You can see the income tax has generated revenue over time. And in most biennia, you've had growth in the, certainly in the 10 to 30% range for the two-year period. You know, these booms, here's the post-war boom, the income tax components were put into place during the war, and then the economy exploded during the war and afterwards as shipbuilding first, and then the harvest off federal lands picked up, the housing boom in the late 40s when the soldiers were coming home from the war, and this really created a boom in revenue. In the 70s, a boom, but in an inflationary period. This growth in the 90s was pretty strong, given that inflation was low. But the point here is, if you look at 0103, the 7.5% drop we talked about earlier, you see how unusual, unique that is. First time in the post-war period that a legislature has been faced with a falling general fund compared to the previous biennium. First decline since 39-41. And the biggest percentage drop since the depth of the recession in 33-35. Remember, the income tax was actually approved by voters in 1930. So this is when it referred by the 29 legislature. So this is kind of the performance of the income tax historically over time. Its percentage of the general fund was smaller in most of these years, usually in about the 60 to 65% range.
So the budgetary climate that we just weathered was more severe than any budgetary climate this legislature has faced since 1933.
In terms of the actual dollars lost, yes, percentage of dollars lost, yes. Now, the recession in here in the early 80s was more severe for the economy, but the revenue percentage revenue losses were not as severe. And of course, you also had some steps that were taken by the legislature. For example, the surcharge, it wasn't actually a surcharge, but the rate increase that took place temporarily for a 3-year period, that revenue shows up here. Otherwise, these numbers would have been lower. So as we look ahead, and we'll ask the state economists to come in and brief you on the latest forecast, the forecast process. That is one of the responsibilities of our revenue committees, is to oversee that forecast process and review it and ensure its objectivity. The December revenue forecast, you can see we do have the recovery in place, and we're tracking pretty closely. We get revenue literally on a daily basis from Department of Revenue, what our withholding is and so forth. We're tracking pretty close right now. But you can see we're not seeing a real strong recovery here, even though we're you know, growing about 8 to 9% these 2 years per biennium. So you've got modest growth in here. Now, the governor was referring to, in his State of the State address, a reserve fund and looking to the future and trying to take a portion of this growth out there and put it into reserve fund. That's what he was referring to when he said the projections are out there for that. I guess the issue to me is, and really the key forecast questions, is what is this long-term trend growth out there? We've assumed it's about 12 to 13%, and you can see that's where the forecast goes to. But you know, what we've seen is way above that and way below it. So, you know, what is that trend? What is that kind of a normal growth rate? And there are a lot of concerns that I think I have and economists have about this number and whether it may actually be a little bit lower as we look ahead if we're in a slow growth environment. Governor's recommended revenue policies, expansion of lottery games. There's $120 million in total new lottery revenue built into the budget. So that's something we want to take a look at with you and see the assumptions behind that. Of course, this is not a decision that you necessarily have to make. I mean, this is, Lottery Commission has the authority to do that. Enhanced collections, the chair mentioned about $23 million in the governor's budget for additional revenue. And Department of Revenue can walk through some of that with you. There's 8 credits that have, due to sunset, the governor recommends extension of those credits. I think there are 4 property tax and 4 income tax. And only 2 of them have really any kind of a significant revenue effect, and it totals a little over $2 million for these 2, the qualified adoption and dependent care assistance tax credits, about $2 million total between the 2 and 0507. So that is part of the governor's recommended budget, and those you'll get those bills to consider. Keep in mind that when you eliminate a credit, not one that's sunsetted, but one that, if you eliminate one that's not sunsetted, it does require the 3/5. It's a general revenue raising measure. Finally, more of an accounting change is on the criminal fine and assessment. About 2/3 of that goes to the general fund. Now, that category has been growing, and the governor's recommending that goes into the general fund totally and then gets allocated back out as general fund revenue. Summary of the revenue system, the relatively low tax burden, which is really the legacy of Measure 5, high reliance on these non-tax revenue sources such as federal funds and charges, which is a response to Measure 5. General fund is highly dependent on the income taxes. Of course, the whole state tax system is highly dependent on income taxes. Now, I haven't really talked about this. Our tax burden is roughly proportional. We've done a lot of analysis on this through our Oregon tax incidence model. And we can walk through any of this whenever you'd like us to. But we think that our tax burden is spread about proportionally with a regressive tail. We think the property tax has a regressive effect at the low end. And then the income tax starts to predominate at the high end. So you have kind of a bowl shape where you've got a higher effective rate at the very high end because of the income tax and a regressive segment due to the property tax at the low end. But if you compare us with other states, with the sales tax usually being much more prominent, our system is not as regressive. Most states are regressive. Washington, of course, is regressive throughout the income spectrum because of the effect of the sales tax. So our burden is roughly proportional. The federal income tax, by the way, is much more progressive than ours. But the feds also rely very much on payroll taxes, which are regressive. Strengths and weaknesses of Oregon's revenue system. And these are just things I think there would be general agreement on. Strengths, you saw the general fund numbers over time. The income tax is a strong revenue producer. And, you know, as you compare it with a sales tax, where the long-term concerns are, if you look at any of the national publications on fiscal trends, and the concern is that with growth of non-tax services like health care, rising in share, and the remote sellers, internet and so forth, that the sales tax will not keep up with income growth over time in the long run as it's currently structured. Of course, that's why there's a lot of concern among the states to try to go with the streamlined sales tax agreement and other ways to capture some of that internet growth. But the income tax will. I mean, it will grow with the economy over time, the way it's structured. Now, we do have some issues, and this came up in our House discussion last week. We do have issues about the aging of our population, and we do have a lower burden. Some of the components of income there are taxed at a lower rate, such as Social Security, for example. Income is not taxed at all in Oregon. That's excluded from our tax base. We have the elderly additional medical deduction that was part of Measure 30. We expect that to grow very rapidly as our population ages and as our medical costs continue to grow. And that will grow as a tax expenditure in your tax expenditure report.
The change that we were making to the elderly medical deduction, I don't remember, though it was defeated, but was that temporary or was that going to be a permanent change to Oregon's tax code? Do you recall?
Mr. Chair, that was a permanent change in Measure 30, and what it did was really the target revenue on that was to reduce the revenue impact by about half. And so what it did was, I believe it was a little over $80 million is the total effect of the subtraction, and it cut it in half. It phased out the additional subtraction based on income so that if you were a single filer, $50,000 and above, you got no additional subtraction.
So it's means tested.
Means tested.
Paul, inheritance tax in Oregon, how do we rank in inheritance tax?
Senator, I don't know the answer to that because that is in such a huge state of flux right now. Of course, the federal government has gone through a dramatic change in its policy toward the inheritance tax. It's kind of the history of that. We could easily spend a day on that issue in terms of orientation, but it's going back to 1917, I think, or maybe 1920, but the feds had it set up so you just took a credit, whatever state tax you paid. So all the states had the same inheritance tax. They basically took the maximum credit because the taxpayer had to pay it to the federal government to pay it to the state, so they might as well pay it to the state from the state standpoint. With that being phased out and now being eliminated, states are going in a lot of different directions as to how to impose an inheritance tax. Washington has established a tax, an inheritance tax now, that I think is $750,000exemption level. Oregon, you may recall, at the end of last session, you passed a bill that connected the state, or at least made it very clear that we were connected to the 1997 federal changes, which will raise the exemption level up to $1 million for Oregon. But we'll keep the inheritance tax in place and was silent on connecting to the 2001 federal changes.
Which was going to be an even higher.
Which was going to push it up to $3 million and eventually phase it out. So right now, that's the status. We do have a good discussion in your public finance packet about where we are. But that's an issue now as the states have gone through or going through a response to the federal. And, of course, it's a whole different policy decision for you now. In the past, it was kind of a no-brainer if everybody had to credit. Mm-hmm. Now you think in terms of differences with it between the states and look at those kinds of issues in a lot of different light. So all the states are kind of reviewing that now.
Senator George.
My understanding of punitive damages, we're at 60% under certain circumstances. Is that correct?
I don't know that, Senator.
Yeah. That's an amazing thing. I mean, it would make you... I thought it should have been an issue during the elections that, you know, if you do win, you're not going to win. And could we get analysis on that, Paul?
I could look that up.
Yeah. Because I was told by a pretty good source that we were at 60% of any award.
The state received?
State took tax at 60%.
For punitive damages.
Mm-hmm. An example was the folks that won the 100 plus million, you know, against the tobacco company.
Mm-hmm.
That the net result that they ended up with in the family was almost nothing. And it was in fact, the attorneys and the state had been the primary beneficiaries, along with a small amount going to federal government. So there was an interesting analysis.
No.
So these other strengths of the system, of course, you have an incentive to reduce the burden on Oregon citizens and still provide the services through the federal government, and that leveraging policy we talked about is, can be seen as an advantage, certainly from that perspective. The proportional distribution of the tax burden, that is somewhat subjective, but in terms of comparison with more regressive systems, it's a strength, or progressive systems have some difficulties at the state level because of the free flowing of factors. People can move across borders very easily. And generally, the distribution approach, economists' perspective on distribution of income based on taxes is it's essentially a political question. But the general consensus is it should be done at the national level where you don't have people moving back and forth and affecting the location of economic resources. And charges, if appropriate, and where costs and benefits roughly match, can be an efficient allocation of resources. So almost like a market. So, of course, economists love that. But there are a flip side of weaknesses in a number of areas. And, of course, the strong revenue growth over time of the income tax in the short run means instability because it's very responsive to changing economic conditions. And of course, we've seen that, the strong growth in the 90s, and strong growth in the 90s followed by the sharp recession and drop in income taxes in the last few years. The high marginal income tax rates, economists always emphasize that it's not average tax but marginal tax, that how much of that additional decision you make, the decision to work more, the decision to invest in new equipment or to locate in the state, those are influenced by that marginal rate. And we do, that it's always a question of the degree of impact, but there's no question that what you tax, you discourage. So whether it be consumption or economic activity of any type, that you're going to discourage. And so high marginal rates would tend to discourage. In general, when you're looking at a tax system, you want to have as broad a base as you can and keep your rates as low as you can so that the market's going to allocate resources most efficiently. So if you're highly dependent on income tax, you run that risk of distorting some of those decisions. The flip side of the federal support, of course, is the things that you've already talked about, that you're subject now to federal budgetary decisions can strongly influence what happens in Oregon. And, of course, the other thing is that we've alluded to briefly is that not only on the budgetary side but on the being an income tax-dependent state, we're highly dependent on the federal government's tax-based decisions because we always have that connection decision to make. And if you do decide, well, we don't want to connect to those federal changes, then, of course, you have some other implications in terms of administration and compliance when you have a different tax base than the feds do. So it really does put you in a situation where there's a strength in having that federal support and linkage, but it's also you can lose control of policy.
You saw that during the recession, for example, when the feds were passing stimulative policies on depreciation and things. Struggling to balance the budget. And finally, if we do have excessive charges, you create competitive positions, particularly if they exceed the benefits. If you charge a company or an economic agent charges that exceed what the benefits are, then of course you're going to be at a disadvantage. And then in areas like higher ed, for example, you run equity problems when you're charging something that has a... You're always making that decision between what proportion of higher ed should be internally borne by the user of that versus how much of it is a general benefit to the state and should be supported by a general tax dollar. So with that...
Thank you very much. Discussion or comments... for Paul.
Good foundation.
We will go through the income tax with you, the property tax, and the excise taxes with you. As we move into the session and these issues come up and you're looking at bills in those specific areas, please use us and use our staff as you develop things. And hopefully this background material will give you, set you to thinking some decisions and get us off to a good start.
It does seem clear to me, and it's been 2 years since I've gone through that presentation, that if you look at our current environment that we're in today, not the short term, but the longer term, if the state wanted to continue to do what it is doing today, the long-term fiscal outlook would not support the services that the state is currently endeavoring to provide, especially that reliance on federal and increasing calls, whether it's schools or corrections, on the state budget. And I don't know, it just seems more clear to me in the back of my head when we were going through this that short term we may be in a semi-sustainable environment, but long term the state could not continue to do what it's doing today and have the means to fund those different endeavors.
I think that's true, Mr. Chair. You know, certainly it's true compared to where we were at the end of the 90s. I mean, that was unsustainable. The income tax revenue that came in was some of it was clearly due to a one-time financial bubble. I don't think anybody anticipates that those kinds of stock market gains to return probably in our lifetimes. So that is unsustainable. But I think the issue, too, about kind of the... sustaining revenue for the current level, that's a national issue. I mean, state and local governments are in that situation, and because costs are growing faster than revenue systems are producing dollars, and of course the other thing that's going on, the economy is changing in significant ways, and yet you have a revenue structure that isn't nearly as responsive to those changes. And you see it all the time. You heard of property taxes, sales taxes, and income taxes too. So as those components change, the revenue systems tend to get left behind in many cases.
It's tough to predict lottery, but, I mean, that was the other great story of the 90s, and I just cannot see that the lottery would continue to, even with the advent of line games and what's going on, and I could be wrong in this, but the changing nature of gambling, I just can't imagine that we would see or be able to expect that type of lottery growth, which we were so dependent on in the 90s, to continue, although it could be a new line game or that we could put into the choices.
Yep, I would agree with you, Mr. Chair. But one thing we did learn about lottery, though, in this recession is it's very stable.
Yeah.
You know, and as long as if you don't change the rules, and of course we also have another alternative there, the tribal gaming opportunity. So there is a competitor in the field. But the gaming activity is pretty stable.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go down much in recessions.
And beer and wine. Thank you. Did Senator Pazansky, did you have a question?
I did. No, I'm looking at it and taking it in, being the new kid on the block. There's a lot to absorb. But I mean, it does seem to me that when we have so much reliance on what the feds are doing, it's really hard for us to be able to plan for a long-term future. And depending on who or what administration is there, whatever their policies are going to be,
will in fact reflect on what we can support or not support.
Situation, although looking at the tea leaves, we've got to think for the next 4 years at least that growth in federal support, at least reading the intentions of the current administration, they're going to clamp down because of the budget. Mm-hmm. So that's just going to have bigger ramifications on Oregon than at least any other state that we look at in terms of our budget.
Well, if we broke out from the rest of the U.S., claim ourselves as a foreign country, maybe we can get a little more assistance.
Tax haven.
Particularly if we launch an attack on the rest of the U.S. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator George.
My good colleague at the other end of the table saw me during the governor's speech kind of tense up a little bit because I was thinking, oh my goodness, I don't think I would stick a fork in the person who sends such a high percentage of our money. But that's just my opinion, and you noticed that I did get very tense, didn't I? And that was the reason right there.
Thank you very much. We'll be seeing Paul on a daily basis, or Monday through Thursday. So the rest of the week we have, tomorrow we have personal income tax, which obviously is the large portion of our tax structure, excise tax, and then property tax, and then the following week I believe we go into the lottery.
We do have a day on school finance and then go to the lottery, and we've invited the lottery director to talk a little bit about kind of their plans, especially in terms of those dollars that are in the governor's budgets and how that process will go on. And then we should, by middle of next week or so, start. We already starting to get bills in, so we'll start to work on scheduling those.
Great. So we'll go at 9 for at least this 2-week interim period. If there are other issues that folks want to look at within the world of revenue or fiscal position, just let Paul or I know and we'll get them into the orientation. With that, we need to adopt the rules.
Yeah.
We're ready to adopt the rules.
And we're checking.
Close public hearing, open work session for the adoption of committee rules.
So moved.
Recognize Senator George, who has moved the adoption of the committee rules, which are before us. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and I think that's got us for today. Thank you. See you tomorrow at 9 a.m. We're adjourned.